Yes.
Hey guys, it's Lavetta.
And it's Miriam.
And this is the Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women. Forgive me, the gardeners just got here with the leaf blower, and as soon as we start to record, and I think that they are out to get me.
I do think it's personal. I do. I think they're like, wait, is she setting up her recording stuff? Let's go. Let's go. Okay.
It's not personal, but it feels personal.
Mm, yes.
And apparently this day and age, how I feel is more important than facts. So,
well, your feelings are facts. Don't you know?
That's true. Mm. And so everything I feel is absolutely true. So I feel that me and Michael B. Jordan are married. So it must be true.
I guess you're married. Congratulations. I'm so happy for you both. I can't wait to walk into the house that I feel is mine, because it's going to be so much bigger than my house.
And have a pool.
That's right. With a slide. Okay. You know.
Yeah. I feel like you love a pool so much that you would have a pool. You would try and do household or motherly things while in the pool.
Yes.
So you would cook in the pool.
Yeah. Yeah.
You would do homework in the
pool. You want your hair braided? Let's go.
In the pool.
Yeah. 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 Like, I'm basically a mermaid. I am Ariel. Okay.
You know, I still haven't seen the live version. I don't like these live action things of like cartoons. I don't like them.
Okay, let's talk about that for a second. Because like I loved it because, I mean, I want to move to that town. Gorgeous. And Halle Bailey. Bailey.
Yeah.
Her voice is just stupid. It's so good. She's beautiful. And I thought she did the role really well. There's some extra songs I didn't think was necessary.
Did they have Under the Sea, the best song of them all?
I mean, they had that too. Yeah. But like, here's the thing. You know, Disney is trying to be like, hey, let's not be racist by creating worlds of people where they're naturally like very, very diverse in a way that doesn't make any sense. So it's one of those things where like,
well,
I don't
Little Mermaid know. She is a mermaid who sings.
Right. And nothing makes sense. That's true. But like,
yeah.
But I think you maybe like, I don't, it's just really like they're trying really, really hard.
I just need them. Why not just remake it and make her chocolate in the cartoon? I don't like the live action stuff.
Couldn't it be like mostly black people? Like,
yeah,
if you're like going to do that, then do that.
I don't mind the diversity because, again, it's about a mermaid, which is not real, and a singing.
It's not.
What is Ursula? Is she an octopus? What is she? Yeah, she's an octopus, right?
That. She has lots of tentacles because she says tentacles. Yeah, okay.
The live version of these are just disconcerting. Even the Lion King one, I didn't like that one. I'm like,
as she was walking through town, if I liked the song better, I wouldn't have, you know, noticed so much. But I don't like the live action things. Mm-hmm. We are not, okay, we should get started, but the Aladdin live action is so good. And
I like the Aladdin one. Yeah, I actually thought that one was really good. You know, some of the special effects are like, but I actually like that one. But I'm talking about like Lion King because it's like,
I didn't watch it.
Lion cubs. Like their mouth is like, I'm Simba. Scar. I'm like, that looks weird.
Also, like, it's a very violent movie, which is fine if it's animated. And so
I still remember the moment when you find out about Scar. I'm traumatized.
Still to this day.
Yes. And Jeremy Irons killed that role.
Damn, Hamlet, your uncle killed your father. I'm sorry. I meant Simba.
And when Simba goes over, Papa, and he's like pushing him to wake up, Mufasa, I was like, Anyway, we are children, but we should get started.
Okay.
This... Guys, before we get started, though, remember to follow us on all the things. Yes, please leave us a 5-star review in the Apple Store. But also, I believe you can do it now on other podcast platforms. I'm not sure you can do it in iHeartRadio, but I think you can do it on... Oh, God. What's the other
Spotify?
One?
You can definitely rate us on Spotify.
Yeah, you can do it on Spotify. So please give us a 5-star review. It helps people find us and find the show. And remember, like I always say, copy the link and send it to your friend. Don't just tell them about it.
Send it to your friends.
Copy the link.
Send it to your friends.
Send it to your friends.
I wrote a song.
And on that note, we are going to get started. I believe I am first this week.
Well, let's do it.
And so this week... you know, last week we had the fabulous Jennifer Lewis. I still can't get over that she took time out of her busy, busy schedule to come on our show. And like, she was so amazing and just so fabulous. And vote.gov, vote.org, vote early if you can, vote.
Yes.
And so this week, you know, we're still in the election cycle.
Yes, we are.
I know. Yes, and I remember last week she talked about Harriet Tubman, you know, like you have to think about like as Harriet was doing these things and saving people, her life as a woman still went on.
Yeah.
She still had her period. She still had to, you know, eat. She had to get up and do her hair. Mm-hmm. She had to do all these things while she's being a hero. And you know, and risking her life, literally. And it made me think about like, you know, as we get closer to election day here in the US, you know, there's so many people are like, well, don't vote. I'm not going to vote. And da, da, da. And I will say black voters have been like, well, that's some bullshit. And so the woman I'm covering today is one of the reasons why I, as a black voter, is like, that's some bullshit. Staying home is not an option for my peoples here in America. Okay. That is not, that is not a fucking option for us. And this is one of the reasons why. So my notorious woman this week is Fannie Lou Hamer.
Oh my God. I love her. Good.
Yes.
Yes.
So those of you who don't know her, you're going to find a little bit about her. Now, she is so extraordinary. She really deserves a two-parter, but we're not really doing that a lot, you know, these days. So just bear with me. It's a lot, but I'm going to get through it. Just, again, tip of the iceberg. Please go. And there's a lot of documentaries about her. Somebody should make a biopic, a movie about her.
Listen,
because she's amazing.
When we talk about our Patreon, if you want to donate to us $50 million, we will make it ourselves. It could be $20
million. It could be $20 million. We'd make a Fannie Lou Hamer movie.
We would. It would be really good, too.
Yeah. It'd be really, really good. And I recommend my girl from King Richard. Who's name? Anjanou Ellis.
Okay. I'll let you be in charge of casting.
She'd be great.
I'm just going to make sure we get all the sets stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Fannie
Lou
Hamer.
I'll handle logistics.
So, and here's why. Okay. So Fannie Lou Hamer was born Fannie Lou Townsend on October 6, 1917 in Montgomery County, Mississippi.
Okay.
Mississippi. To Lou Ella and James Townsend, both sharecroppers. Like most children of sharecroppers, she was the last of 20 children, so grew up in poverty, often going hungry and cold, despite her family working extremely hard every single day.
Yep.
Now, at age 6, Fannie Lou, after being lured into working in the fields by a landowner with the promise of Cracker Jacks, she joined her family picking cotton. Now, let me tell you this little story, this side story. So she tells a story. Basically, she's 6 years old and her family, again, she's the youngest of 20 kids. So they're all in the fields, the ones who are old enough. She's six. She's playing nearby. And the landowner comes up to her and says, "Hey, little Fannie Lou, how you doing?" She's like, "Oh, I'm doing fine." He was like, "How would you like to help out, you know, your family or, you know, and so she started talking about stuff she'd like to get from the general store. So he says to her, "Hey, if you pick 30 pounds of cotton in a week, I'll take you down to the general store and you can get anything you want. Because he's like, have you ever had Cracker Jacks? And she's like, no. And again, this is a family that, despite working so hard, were often hungry. And there's 20. Right. So there's 22 of them, at least, in the household. Yeah. There's 20 kids and
that's
two
a lot
parents.
Of kids. Right. That's a lot of UTIs. OK.
And they're working so hard, because sharecropping is basically neo slavery. And I'll get to that in just a moment. So she's like, oh, that sounds good. So she goes to her parents and they were like, you sure you want to do this? And she's like, yeah, I want to do it. So she does it. She picks 30 pounds in a week. He takes her down to the general store. She picks out Cracker Jacks. I think she said like a sausage and then like some sardines or something.
Okay.
So basically he paid a six-year-old something that probably cost $2 to pick.
Oh, he didn't
30
give her
pounds.
Any money from the work itself. It was just the 30 cents it cost him to buy her some food because she was hungry. What a fucking asshole piece
of shit. Because
she's
born in 1917. Okay. So this is what, 1923?
Yeah.
1923, 1924. Yeah. So the next week she's like, but it was a trap, because the next week she was tasked with picking 60.
What a
pounds.
Fucking asshole. I want to hang by the balls.
When I heard that, it made me so mad. And she was telling the story many years later. She's in her 40s by the time she's telling the story. But a six-year-old.
Mm-mm.
A six-year-old.
Mm-mm.
So this is how you lure a six-year-old into working, right? Because then she's like, I'm helping out, da-da-da. And I get Cracker Jacks and sardines. Like,
disgusting.
Yeah. So, when I heard her say that, I was like, I wanted to push him down a deep, deep, dark well, because he
the
basically
kind where,
tricked
like,
a child.
If you yell, no one can hear you.
Yeah.
That's a slow
now,
death.
During the winters, she attended the one-room school provided for the sharecropper's children, open between picking seasons. So they went to school because it was too cold to go out in the fields. Now, as a child, she loved reading and excelled in spelling bees and reciting poetry.
Okay.
So she's very bright. But by the age of 12, she had to leave school and began to work full time to help her to support her family, her aging parents, 12. So by age 13, she was picking between 200 and 300 pounds of cotton daily while working with polio at one point.
What? Okay. Damn.
Now.
The fuck? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. This motherfucker lured a child into picking cotton and paid her with, like you said, whatever. It probably wasn't even $2. Maybe 30 cents.
Easy. Yeah. That shit was like 10 cents, right?
Yeah, if that. Now, I hear an echo. Do you have your headphones plugged in?
Yep.
Why do I hear an echo?
Okay.
Are mine plugged in? Let me make sure. Okay. Okay. I'll probably have to fix it in post. But anyway. Okay. So now in 1944, she married Perry Hamer, and the couple worked on the D. Marlowe Plantation in Mississippi, owned by W. D. Marlowe, until about 1962.
Okay.
Because she was the only worker who could read and write, because remember, she went to school up until 12.
Right.
She would eventually go on to serve as timekeeper over the work fields. Now, again, sharecropper, like people who are not in the States may not know, or people who are in the States may not know, is basically a form of neo-slavery at the time.
Yeah.
So after the Civil War, black people who didn't leave, the plantation that they probably, for many generations, their family had been forced to work on, they went off or went up north or went out west. But the ones who stayed nearby oftentimes were lured into this thing. Basically, so the setup was that they would give you a plot of land. You would continue to work the fields. They would give you a plot of land where you can grow your own things, supposedly.
Theoretically.
And they would start to pay you. But the pay was so small, and you were always trying to catch up depending on the harvest, that you were always behind. So even though you would work 6 days a week, one day off to go to church, so no day to rest, you would always be behind financially, and you would never have enough to get ahead.
Now, let's talk about that for a second, because I think that our country continues to do this as a general rule. This is why we're trying to vote for the poor people to get ahead. And the other side, the other team, the team that inspires you to go to the polls and vote blue, thank you, want poverty to flourish. Because if poverty flourishes, then you have a class of people that are dependent on you, and they will do what they need to do to survive. You can tell them what it is you want them to do. It's a way of controlling a population. Okay.
Well, also, on top of that, they'll be
today.
Well, they'll be so busy trying to survive.
Yes.
They won't have time to demand better wages. So
that's right.
Now, some of you out there might be like, well, why don't they just leave? Right. Well, some of them would leave. So these are honorable people who were God fearing Christian people who went to church on their one day off, who believed in God and by doing right. So but even if they say so, and so they will work in a system it's designed so they never get out of debt to these.
Right. Right.
These landowners. Right. But let's say they manage to break even and they're like, we're going to head off. Right. Oftentimes the overseers, because these were basically still working plantations. Now, this is the 1920s, 1930s. Slavery's been over for a while, but the conditions are still basically the same. Right.
Oh, yeah.
So let's say they manage to break even and they're like, well, we're going to leave. Right. That's one of the reasons we have the great migration in the United States of black people from the South to the North. We're going to leave. No, they need a subservient, dependable workforce. So they would often either people who work for the plantation or the landowners themselves or the overseer would sabotage people's automobiles.
Yep.
So they couldn't leave. And then let's say that how could they not get ahead in their plot of land, right? They would often poison the mules and other work animals so they didn't have means to work their own land to get a harvest that was successful enough. So again, it's all designed to keep you working nonstop for pennies. And, you know, and to your point, Miriam, now that they were used to black people being in this position, right? And poor white people too being in this position. Yep. But now in the modern society here in America, they want everybody to do that, as evident by the way they were behaving during the pandemic. Get back to work, get back to work, get back to work, right? Even though there's COVID running rampant, get back to work, get back to work.
Yep.
Because, and then they were saying that they didn't want to pay you for working, for not working if you were sick. Get back to work.
Right. Yeah.
Then exposing other workers who would have to work even though being sick. And one of the reasons these people hate the U.S. government, the federal government, is because A, it goes back to slavery, because it's like, how dare you tell us what to do with our slaves and our wealth, right?
Right.
But then the government comes in and it's like, no, we will pay for employees who have to stay home from sick in order to keep work going. They don't want to pay the people because it's not about the money, as they say. It's about, like you said, Miriam, keeping people so desperate and barely surviving that they have to work.
They have to do what you say, which keeps
you have to do
in
what
power.
You say. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So this is what Fannie Lou Hamer, because again, they work 14-hour days.
Yeah.
6 days a week. And they still didn't have enough food.
The whole their lazy narrative.
Yeah.
Motherfucker, you're lazy. They're
the opposite.
Because imagine,
people aren't afraid of hard work. People are like, I work hard, but I should have enough food and heating oil to keep our place from being cold.
Yeah.
Like, why are we working? And so much so that young Fannie Lou said that, you know, when she was young, when she became a teenager at some point, she was like, I want to be white, because she's like, I looked around and white people didn't work hard, but they had big homes and they had plenty of food.
Mm-hmm. She's not wrong. Yeah.
So I want to be that. Like, they don't have to work this hard, but they still have more. How is that possible?
Sounds nice. Right.
Yeah.
That sounds
nice. Very, very nice. Yeah.
Okay.
So again, so that's a system she grew up in. Now, she was a devout Christian. Like I said, she worked hard, prayed hard, and believed that God would answer her prayers. Okay. In 1961, she went to get a uterine tumor removed. It was a benign tumor by all accounts. But the white doctor, without her consent, took her uterus.
What a fucker.
Just took her, gave her a hysterectomy. It was basically forced sterilization of black women. Yeah. And it was a way to reduce the black population. It was so widespread to take black women's uteruses without their consent. It was dubbed, in Mississippi, it was dubbed a Mississippi appendectomy.
Jesus Christ.
Just took it. So, unable to have children of her own, she and her husband would eventually adopt two daughters because she loved, and she, by all accounts, she's very nurturing, and she came from a loving family. Like her parents, everybody's loving, but they worked hard and they never saw the fruits of their labor pay off. Now, in the summer of 1962, she's now in her 40s. So this was, she's been working in the field since she was six.
Dang.
So 30 plus years, right? Now, she's been working hard her whole life. Her family worked hard her whole life. I'm sure she saw her grandparents work hard their whole life with nothing to show for it. And so she's like, there's got to be a better way. So she started to believe by hearing talk around town, this is in 1962, that, you know, black people could better their circumstances if they had political power.
Right.
You know, she heard people talk about like, well, you can organize, start voting and vote these people out.
Yeah.
Who aren't helping you.
Right.
But now voting, you might ask, but she can vote. Like, why isn't she voting? So voting's been legal since after the Civil War for black men. And then after white women got the right to vote, it's supposed
black
to be
women.
Right.
Theoretically.
Black women are right. Theoretically. Yeah. But in Mississippi and a lot of states in the South and other parts of the country, it was very difficult for black people to actually become voters and register to vote because they were often in place very arbitrary laws designed to keep them from voting, including literacy tests.
Yep.
Meaning which a lot of the white people who were conducting the test couldn't even pass themselves.
Yeah.
Let's just keep that. And they used to do this thing where they called it the grandfather clause, meaning if your grandfather didn't vote, then you couldn't vote. So this is how they kept them out, right? And then downright physical threats if you just even showed up.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just for black people, all non-white people. So even the few Asian people in the area, if you're not white, you don't have the same rights as white people, point blank, period, in America during this time. Now, at this time, Mississippi was 70% black, but all the elected officials were white.
Oh, my God. Okay, so I'm going to plug. Remember our conversation with Denise Nicholas?
Mm-hmm.
She wrote the most beautiful book. And I'm looking up the name of the book that everyone needs to get. I can't remember what it's called. Listen, Google Denise Nicholas. Where is the name of her book? It is Freshwater Road.
Yeah.
Y'all, it will give you that insight to what Mississippi was like back in the day. It is darker than any way we can.
Yeah.
I don't know the words, but that shit's intense and real.
And the South is at this time, it's the stereotypical image of the South that you guys think of during this time. It was that. But in Mississippi, it was even worse.
Yeah. It's terrifying.
So that's how racist Mississippi is, right? Mississippi.
And here's the thing with that book that she wrote it because she went there and she did that.
Exactly. Yeah. She's part of those young people who came down. So now Fannie Lou was, you know, the older she got. And then she starts looking back on like what happened to her when she was six. And you start thinking, this motherfucker trick.
Yeah.
So she became incensed just tired. You know, one of her quotes is, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Right.
Yeah.
So now she started to, you know, just get out more and see how she can get more information about the things, how to change her plot in life. So she attended a meeting led by civil rights activist James Forman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a.k.a. SNCC, and James Bevel of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the SCLC, a.k.a. Martin Luther King's organization. And she voiced her anger at her efforts, at the efforts in the state to deny black people the right to vote and change their circumstance. Now, encouraged by these meetings, because they started telling her, oh, yeah, you can do all this stuff. And she's like, really? Well, let's do that.
Yeah,
she's
right.
Just like, let's.
Okay, let's
now,
go.
So she got involved in doing what she could. Now, she's in her 40s. So she became a SNCC organizer. And on August 31st, 1962, she actually led 17 volunteers to register to vote at the Indianola, Mississippi courthouse.
Okay.
Again, they were denied the right to vote due to an unfair literacy test. Okay. So these are local people, right? Now, the group was harassed on their way home as well, and the police stopped their bus and fined them $100 for the trumped up charge of the bus being too yellow.
Wow.
So Woo. They're like, yeah, the bus is too yellow.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. Now, $100 in 1962 would be about $1,000 today.
Jesus Christ.
These are sharecroppers who are barely they don't have enough money to even buy their own food, right? So weekly. And I mean, as a group, and probably SNCC has this, you know, an emergency fund or whatever, yeah. But this is ridiculous. That's a lot of money. Now, that night, so she gets back home. So the registrar office called her boss.
Okay.
And said, Fannie Lou was down here trying to register to vote. And she put in her request to register to vote. So she put it in. When she got home, her boss fired her. He gave her an ultimatum. I need you to go down there and take your name out. And she's like, no. So he fired her.
Wow.
Fired
her. Piece of shit. So many pieces of shit. Jesus.
Now, her husband was required to stay on until the harvest. But her boss confiscated much of their property. Now, she said, well, you guys stay on, her and he and the two girls. And so she's like, you know, I'll be fine. I'm going to go at some point into another place and, you know, figure out if I can get a job there, probably being a maid or what have you, what I can do. Right. This is a small town, still another small town. But her husband got a premonition like, oh, I don't know. I feel like this is going to get bad. You know, white folks are upset. Like, I think you need to leave. And he was right, because less than 2 weeks after her registering the vote, at least 16 bullets punctured their home.
Oh, my God.
All for her trying to register to vote.
God damn.
So after the harvest, they were out of luck. So the family had no source of income and no home now, because this Marlo guy just threw them out. Right.
Right.
And also, who wants to live in a house full of bullets? So,
no one.
So they finally reunited and they moved to Ruleville, Mississippi in Sunflower County with very little money. So you've been working. They both have been working 30 plus years. Sun up, sun down, 6 days a week. Nothing.
Right.
Nothing. Because she had the audacity to register to vote. Now, the same year, she went to the National SNCC Conference, and Fannie Lou Hamer became a hit. Because when you look her up, she's like she's a straightforward, warm, kind of intelligent, but she speaks plain folk speak. Because she's just a woman with a 6th grade education. But she's highly intelligent, but she's just plain speaking. And she became like a hit because the people in these organizations, like Miss Denise Nicholas, when she was young, these are college educated people. They speak a certain way, and they're trying to talk to plain folk in the South in particular. And so they come across as kind of like, you know, these people may be intimidated or may not feel like these people know what their plight actually is. But with Fannie Lou, she's like, no, I'm one of y'all. Like, I know exactly
Fannie
what.
Fannie Lou walked in and they all wanted to have a beer with her.
To have a beer with her. She was incredibly charismatic, charismatic. And they realized, they were like, this is the kind of leader that we need to be speaking for us on behalf in the South. This is what we want. She's a star. Right. She's with us. She's hardworking, all this stuff. Now, the following year, on June 9th, 1963, after successfully completing a voter registration program in Charleston, South Carolina, Miss Fannie Lou Hamer and several other Black women were arrested for sitting in a white-only bus station restaurant in Winona, Mississippi. Now, she would say that the women went in to get something to eat, to stop, and she was actually on the bus. And so they just started arresting them, and she actually came out of the bus to see what was going on. And she heard, I think it was a highway patrolman be like, get her, get her.
Oh,
so they so they arrested her, and along with the other women, and three white men, including the highway patrolman, take her down to her cell, and then they're trying to figure out who's who, and she says she heard the women being attacked while she's waiting.
What the fuck?
Right. So then they came in and asked her who she was and where she was from. So they were like, all right. So they left and came back and they were like, oh, OK, so you are who you say you are. And then it got really nasty and really dark because they came into her cell and they said, we gonna make you wish you were dead.
Jesus.
So the beating. So so she was beaten brutalized. She was brutalized.
Ugh.
And it left her with lifelong injuries, a blood clot in her left eye, right kidney damage, and leg damage. She also later learned that several of the other women had also brutally been beaten. And I'm going to get into her testimony in a minute where she talks candidly about exactly what happened. But this experience obviously is terrifying. And it left her badly beaten and she had to recover. So after taking some time to recover, though, she became even more determined to do what she was doing.
Wow.
So in 1964, her reputation, her national reputation soared as she co-founded the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party,
MFDP. Okay.
Now, and it was as part of her bid to run for Congress, because she's like, well, I'm going to run for Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Don't fuck with me.
Which is great. And it challenged the local Democratic Party's efforts to block Black participation. Because remember how I was saying that Mississippi was racist, even for racist Southerners?
Yeah, like, even racist Southerners were like, ooh, they're racist.
You know? These people, because of the two parties, even then, the Democratic Party was the most, at least, open to Black participation nationwide. But in Mississippi, the Democratic Party was just as racist, probably more racist than the Republican Party. Even more so that the Mississippi Democratic Party didn't even support the Democratic nominee for president. They supported the Republican candidate, Barry Goldwater.
Fucking hate Black people so much.
Jesus. This is how racist the Mississippi Democratic Party was.
I just want to be clear that right now, if you're in Mississippi, please vote for Kamala. Thank you.
yeah.
Best you can.
Yeah, exactly. Now, so for Fannie Lou and her team, they figured that approaching, you know, her bid for Congress or even just making inroads into the Mississippi Democratic Party, they figured that they had to put pressure on the National Democratic Party to put pressure on the Mississippi Democratic Party.
Yes, they did. She's right.
Yes. So in 1964 was a voting year. So they needed to challenge. So they decided that they would challenge the credentials of the current Mississippi Democratic Party and the national level at the Democratic National Convention. So because she and her party, it was basically an integrated party with Black and white people. So the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was an integrated Democratic Party, but the traditional Mississippi Democratic Party going to the national convention was not. It was all white.
That sounds
now.
Right.
Now, so they decided when they went to the DNC, the Democratic National Convention that year in Atlantic City, that what they were going to do was challenge the credentials of the current party in favor of the more integrated party, right?
Perfect.
So she and the other MFDP members went to the convention in Atlantic City that year, 1964, demanding to be recognized as the official delegation. And so a bunch of people gave testimony and including her. Now, this is what she said. I'm going to read this in most of her speech, not in entirety, but most of her speech, because it's so powerful. So, quote, I was carried. So she's reciting, before I get started, she's reciting what happened to her when she was arrested for registering people to vote and was brutalized, right?
Go ahead.
Okay, quote, I was carried out of the cell, of that cell into another cell, which they had two Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. That's like a billy cup. Okay. The first Negro prisoner ordered me by orders from the state highway patrolman for me to lay down on a bunk bed on my face. Ugh. And I laid on my face. The first Negro began to beat me. And I was beat by the first Negro until he was exhausted. I was holding my hands behind me at the time on my left side because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. After the first Negro had beat me until he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat and I began to work my feet. And the state patrolman ordered the first Negro who had beat me to sit on my feet to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over and pulled my dress. I pulled my dress down and he pulled my dress back up. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first class citizens. And if the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off the hooks because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you. End quote. Yeah. So you motherfuckers out there talking about black people don't vote, you shut your fucking face and you stay out of our business. Ain't no way in hell we not going to exercise our right to vote. And before Miss Fannie Lou Hamer was beat, brutalized for registering other black people to vote, so many of our people died, hung from trees for the right to vote that you motherfuckers are like, well, I'm not going to vote. So you just giving up your vote willingly. Fuck you forever. Don't ever come in a black person's face and tell us not to vote in this motherfucking country. Because we're literally doing this from blood, sweat, and tears. So y'all can fuck off forever. Don't ever, 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 ever say something like some shit like that. Because if you say that, then you definitely don't know America and you are not American. You are not a patriot. So because voting is our natural given right that we have worked hard for. It should have come easily that it comes to so many of y'all today. And y'all just willingly giving up y'all vote. This man, this girl was tricked. And now we realize she had polio when she was six.
I didn't
know. So some motherfucker came and tricked a 6 year old with polio into picking cotton for Cracker Jacks, sardines and some little sausages. And then when she got old enough and she knew better and she said, voting will change my life. This is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to help other people change their lives. And I go in and talk to them about doing that. And I get brutalized, get attacked by basically four grown ass men. So y'all can fuck off forever. And that's on my mama. Anyway, now. When Lyndon B. Johnson.
Go on.
So now the National Democratic Party, they didn't like to be told what to do. They were like,
yeah.
Also, they kind of wanted to keep the fact that Mississippi Democratic Party was going rogue and they wanted to keep it under wraps. They wanted to present a united front against the Republicans. Right.
Yeah.
So but also Lyndon B. Johnson being a white man from the South of this era. He was just like, who is these Negroes telling me what to do? Right. So he took this attitude. He also, so when he found out that basically she was going to be one of the people speaking, because he wasn't afraid of Martin Luther King and he wasn't afraid of it. He was afraid of Fannie Lou Hamer because she's actually on the ground. She represents the people that they are trying to advocate for. Right.
Yep,
she's not.
Yep.
Her speech was so powerful. So he was just like, I'm not, you know, apparently the Democratic National Convention, Hubert Humphrey said, quote, the president would not allow the illiterate woman to speak from the floor of the convention, end quote.
Wow.
Yeah. So and all they came there just to advocate and say that the integrated delegation from Mississippi should be seated, not this all white racist one.
Right.
That's all they were asking. Right now. So Fannie Lou decided, you know, she just spoke from the heart.
Yeah.
They're trying to basically get the national convention to, again, acknowledge the integrated delegation,
mm-hmm.
not the all white one. So,
right.
But President Lyndon B. Johnson was like, I got something for her. So when he knew that she was getting ready to speak and give this speech that I just recited.
Yeah.
He called a press conference at the White House because he knew that the traditional media would cut away from her speech because this was being televised.
What a fucking piece of shit. Okay, go on.
So he basically called this conference and they're like, oh, it must be something important back then when it was important when the president called a press conference. He basically called to say some arbitrary thing. Oh, it's been 9 months since so and such happened. So when the reporters were like, this is what you, what? They were like, okay, all right, okay. So he finishes as soon as her speech finishes.
God right? damn him to fucking hell.
But
go on.
Because her speech was so powerful, word got back to other news organizations that, oh my God, her speech was the highlight of the right. broadcast. Everything was great. People were like, oh my God, this is so moving. News organizations and different newsrooms decided to replay her speech several more times for several days following the rebroadcast.
Lyndon B. Johnson. Okay. Yeah.
Highlighting what was going on at the Democratic National Convention, right? Now, ultimately, the MFDP were not seated. So they gave their speeches, she testified, and they came back with a compromise. So they said that, yeah, we would offer two members of the MFDP delegates at large.
What does that
mean?
So
not real delegates, basically representing no one. It was a compromise of sorts.
That's not a thing. Okay.
So they rejected the offer.
Good.
And Fannie Lou said, quote, we didn't come all the way up here to compromise for no more than what we got in here. We didn't come all this way for no two seats when all of us is tired. End
quote. Yeah.
Now, so afterward, all the white members of the Mississippi delegation, the racist one, walked out just in protest.
Bye.
Now,
okay.
4 years later in 1968, the MFDP was finally seated
after
the Democratic Party adopted a clause that demanded equality of representation from their state's delegations.
Okay, thanks. That's why we need that. Okay.
Yeah. Now, in 1972, she was elected as a National Party delegate as well. Later on. So now many historians believe that this challenge that she brought to the 1964 convention changed the modern Democratic Party at a national level. And it changed the face of the Democratic Party politics in the U.S.
Interesting.
Now, later that year, Miss Fannie Lou Hamer, Victoria Gray, and Annie Devine became the first black women to stand in the U.S. Congress when they unsuccessfully protested the Mississippi House election of 1964.
Okay.
Now, after this, she was, you know, she was encouraged, but they were, you know, she was upset. But because of this broadcast, she became nationally known. So she began traveling extensively, speaking on behalf of civil rights. And she actually traveled to Africa with members of SNCC.
Okay.
She was transformed by the experience in a positive way. Because remember I said that growing up, she was like, well, I wish I was white because they don't have to work as much and they have food and they have big houses. And, you know, she said from that moment when she went to Africa and saw black people in charge, something that she had not seen in Mississippi.
Right.
She said from that moment on, she was never ashamed of her ancestors or of her background or of who she was. Okay. Now, her style of speaking and connecting to the audiences was just charismatic and undeniable. And it was traced back to her upbringing and her Black Baptist church upbringing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that call and response, straight speak. But in like she had that natural like way that she could sway people and just. But she also herself was very charismatic.
Yeah.
So a lot of people wanted to see her in person, to see her speak and like. Yeah, she was just sort of great. Now, not sort of, she was absolutely great. Now, woven into her speeches was a deep level of confidence. Again, here's this, you know, plus size black woman with this plain speak. She had a ton of biblical knowledge. She had a wonderful singing voice, but she also had a lot of like hard won confidence just living her life for 40 something years. And she was funny. So, you know, so again, she was so charming and so wonderful. And she came from a childhood. Now, her mother, when she was growing up, her mother carried a concealed pistol to protect the children from the white landowners in these plantations, who were known to beat sharecroppers' children just willy nilly. Again, neo-slavery.
Yeah.
Now, but she began to travel, and she helped organize the Freedom Summer with hundreds of college students, including Miss Denise Nicholas.
Yeah, and, shout out again. Go Freshwater Road, y'all. Go get it.
Exactly.
It's on Amazon.
And a lot of these college kids were both black, white, black and white, to help with black voter registration in the segregated South.
Yeah.
She also became a voice in the North. So she started traveling to the North as to what was going on and still going on with people, with black people in the South, and also in their own words, because she was a great representative for them, for black Southern people. She also, you know, you ask, well, why didn't she just move and leave? Because she wanted to help her own people in her own state. And so she started to emphasize that with young activists coming up under her who were inspired by her to get involved, that let's try and make change here. Because if we make change here, it goes out into the rest of America.
Right.
But
she's right.
Still, she was frustrated by the political process, because back then, you couldn't just easily go out and vote like you can now. So go out and fucking vote, people. And yeah, cry me a fucking river. Anyway, she turned her focus to economics as a strategy for greater racial equality. So in 1968, with the help of the National Council of Negro Women, she began what she called a pig bank.
Okay.
So basically, it was free pigs for black farmers to breed, raise, and slaughter. And then, so what would happen? They would come in and get a pig.
Okay.
They would use it to, you know, raise it up, to even breed it to produce other little piglets. And then all they had to do, what was asked of them, is to bring back one of the little piglets that then can be donated to somebody else.
Yes.
So paying
perfect.
It forward.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so this was wonderful because it provided a source of food, but also where they can sort of get stuff started unless people come and poison their animals again. But, you know. Now, she later launched the Freedom Farm Cooperative, FFC, buying up land that black people could own and farm collectively.
Oh, that's great.
With the assistance of donors, including famed singer Harry Belafonte, she purchased 640 acres and launched a co-op store, a boutique, and a sewing enterprise. So for them to become self-sufficient.
Right.
Smart. She single-handedly ensured that 200 units of low-income housing was built.
Wow.
Some of them That's still amazing. Exist today in Ruleville.
Really? Really?
Yeah. Now, these acts that she was just doing in her own local community encouraged so many more people, young and old, to become involved in, like, what can they do on the ground economically? What can they do politically, or a little bit of both? Because you need a whole bunch of stuff.
You need
right?
a lot.
In their own,
Yeah.
In their own backyard where they are. Now, right? Many have said that Fannie Lou Hamer is one of the greatest folk leaders in this country's history. She's one of the greatest folk leaders ever produced in America because of these kinds of acts. In 1971, she helped found the National Women's Political Caucus because she's also a feminist.
Yeah, she is.
She started doing extensive travel and fundraising, and it often took her away from the day-to-day operations of the FFC. This is why you also have to start train people so they can keep things going, you know, but people also have to be willing. You can't do it all yourself. Now, unfortunately, the FCC lasted only until like the mid to late 70s. But at its heyday, it was the largest employer in Sunflower County.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So, but all this work and traveling around became to take its toll on her, not to mention her ongoing aches and pains from the brutal attack.
I wondered about that.
Less than a decade earlier. Now, in January of 72, she had an extensive stay in a hospital for nervous exhaustion.
Okay.
She was hospitalized again in January of 74 for a nervous breakdown. So by 1974, June of 1974, she was said to be in extremely poor health. So it's just taken its toll on her. And again, this woman worked since she was six in a cotton field.
Yeah.
with not polio. Getting enough food. And then when she finally does go to the hospital for to get her tumor removed, they take out her uterus. Yeah.
The amount of brutality that has been inflicted on her body mm-hmm. is excessive. And we actually, like, I've heard of Fannie Lou Hamer. I have a vague idea. Like, I love her. But she's doing all this, you know, Ginger Rogers backwards and in heels. She's doing all, like, forwards and in pain. Like,
and in pain.
Yeah.
So it's starting to take its toll on her. And then, you know, she's getting up there in age, too. So now two years later, in 76, she was diagnosed and had surgery for breast cancer.
Ugh. Okay. Because
I imagine working in the fields around all that pesticide, all that other stuff is not helping either.
No. Yeah.
By that time, also, the FFC was struggling. And I'm sure the local efforts to sabotage it were also in full effect. Because black people are happy and being self-sufficient, the thing you guys claim you want them to do, is threatening to you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, eventually, because of lack of funds, it folded in 1977.
Oh, so it was like a 6-year program?
Yeah, basically. Oh, okay. Now, not long after that, on March 14th, unfortunately, Miss Fannie Lou Hamer died. On March 14th, 1977, from complications from hypertension and breast cancer at age 59.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Way too young.
Yeah. She was buried on land that she owned, which was a dying wish of hers not to be buried on a plantation.
Yes.
Her tombstone is engraved with one of her famous quotes, quote, "I am sick and tired of being sick and tired,"
yes.
end quote. She was survived by her husband, Perry, and her two daughters, Virgie Lee and Dorothy Jean. Now, her primary memorial service held at a church was completely full. An overflow service was held later on at Central High School with over 1,500 people in attendance. Andrew Young, United States Ambassador to the UN, spoke at the main service. And then he said of her, quote, "None of us would be where we are now had she not been there then," end quote.
It's beautiful. And now, it's so true.
Like, for someone who went to school only until age 12, after her death and during her lifetime, actually, she rightfully received honor and acknowledgement of her work in civil rights. She also received a doctor of law from Shaw University, honorary mm-hmm. degrees from Columbia College Chicago and Howard University.
Yes, girl.
She was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame in 1993. She also received the Paul Robeson Award from these Black Sorority AKAs, the Mary Church Terrell Award from Black Sorority Delta Sigma Theta, and the National Sojourner Truth Meritorious Service Award. Now, she's an honorary member of Delta Sigma Theta, and she's remembrance of her life was given in the U.S. House of Representatives on the 100th anniversary of her birth in 2017. Right. Now, there's several schools and libraries and many, many things that have been named in honor of Fannie Lou Hamer, including post offices.
Yeah.
The Fannie Lou Hamer National Institute on Citizenship and Democracy was founded in 97 as a summer seminar from K-12 workshop program. In 2014, it merged with the Council of Federated Organizations Civil Rights Education Complex on the campus of Jackson State University to create the Fannie Lou Hamer Institute at COFO, a human and civil rights interdisciplinary education center. So now, again, like I said, there's many, many schools and many, many things named after her. And there's also many works of art in theater, poetry, et cetera, written in her honor. No biopic, though, which is what we can produce.
We're going to do
if
that.
If you donate that.
If you give us enough money for it.
Now, most
just
fittingly.
Just put a little asterisk. Tell us what you want to do with that money. You got it.
Exactly. Like, you know, fittingly, a plaque documenting her 1964 speech at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City is carved on one of the 11 granite columns at the Civil Rights Garden in Atlantic City,
That's
where the convention
fantastic.
Was held.
Oh, my
now,
God.
Now, today,
good.
In closing, her legacy is still alive. Whenever and wherever you see community activists, they are the children of Fannie Lou Hamer. Now, in ending, I want to read a quote of hers because I always like to end in their own words.
Okay.
She had many, many quotable quotes, but I thought this one was so poignant. Quote, "Never to forget where we came from and always praise the bridges that carried us over," end quote. And that is Fannie Lou Hamer. One of the main reasons why I will never, as a Black person in America, say I'm not going to vote.
That's right. Fannie Lou Hamer. She's incredible. Thank you so much for her. Because I know of her, but it's so much more powerful to get the whole picture of like where she came from and what, yeah. You know, and she also, when people, you know, look how much she did, right? Mm-hmm. Like the very least you can do in this country is vote.
Yeah.
It's really
the bare minimum.
The bare minimum. You should do more. You don't have to Fannie Lou Hamer it. But
Yeah.
She did. Because
you got jobs, families, kids. I get it. But the very least you can do is vote, and vote nationally and locally.
And locally. Yeah. They're both important. Look it up. You got to look it up. Not all the elections are like in your face like this one is. But that's enough of our TED Talk.
Sorry, that was a little long, but
that's okay.
Who's your notorious woman this week?
Okay, we're taking a totally different journey now.
Okay.
Now, I don't know. I just found this interesting because I do a lot. Total side note, y'all. We're moving on, but don't forget to vote. Okay.
Exactly.
I post a lot of stuff that talks about, and we talked about it with Alexa, about diet culture and exercise culture and like what it's done to our society and what it's done to women specifically. So let's talk about a woman named Jean Nidich. And I'm just going to tell you, she's the woman.
Jean Nidich. I know that name.
She started Weight Watchers.
Oh. Uh-huh.
So she was the one who essentially pushed the narrative that mainstream, not just America, internationally, should go on a diet. It wasn't, right? So like, let's talk about her. Let's just talk about her. Sometimes I'm like, this is an evil person and this is a wonderful person. Jean is an interesting person.
Okay.
So she was born Jean Evelyn Slutsky in Brooklyn, October 12th, 1923. Her parents were David and May Rodan Slutsky. Dad was a cab driver and her mom was a manicurist. There is nothing more Brooklyn than what I just said. Okay.
Oh my God, I know.
Now she talks about, so she wrote a book later that she would compulsively eat as a child. As a quote, I don't remember. I'm going to start that again because I said it's a quote. Quote, I don't really remember, but I'm positive that whenever I cried, my mother gave me something to eat. I'm sure that whenever I had a fight with a little girl next door or it was raining and I couldn't go out or I wasn't invited to a birthday party, my mother gave me a piece of candy to make me feel better. End quote. We all love to blame our mothers. It's fun.
Yeah. And I will say with working class and poor people, food is comfort because, as I mentioned with Fannie Lou Hamer, not having food could also be your reality.
Right. Yeah. You know, food is comfort when a trip to Hawaii is unavailable. You know,
amen to that. Haagen-Dazs is a comfort when you can't afford to go to China.
There you go.
To the Great Wall.
Right. You understand me. Okay.
Exactly.
Let's fly to New York and see a great show for $800 or, okay. Yeah.
$800? You mean $1,800 at this point.
I mean, I thought you were like, that's too much. No, it's on sale today. Yeah. Come on down. Okay. So her and her sister, she has a sister, younger sister named Helen, and they both grew up chubby and they both struggled to control their weight. But Jean was also like a really popular girl. She was a talker and she had a circle of overweight friends, which I mean, I don't know. That's what I read. It's very specific.
I wonder when they say overweight back then, do they mean like an extra 10 pounds or
Yes, you know? They do. There wasn't enough food circulation to be more than that.
and didn't have hormones in the food they have
I
now.
I mean, right? So it's like, I mean, listen, I have family members who are like, oh, this was when I was over. I see the old pictures and I'm like,
yeah,
that's just normal. You were just normal.
Or it's just like a little, it's like a little weight. Like overweight is different than like, he's just heavier, like big boned, some as we say.
People, yeah, some people, like most people just like, they have like a set weight. Like that's where you're comfortable. Yeah, yeah. That's where you eat healthy and smart, but also have treats because you're human and live in the world. You know, like that's your, you're not hungry all the time weight, right?
Yeah.
But who knows? So she graduated from girls' high school in Brooklyn. She joined the IRS as a clerk in 1942. Now, in 1947, now this is what it said. So there was a 2-year courtship. Her husband, Mortimer Nyditch, okay? they dated for 2 years, largely spent gormandizing. Now, what? Now, I think that's like a retrospect memory of when they were dating. Now, I'm sure that they were both hefty and they both enjoyed delicious food together.
Mm-hmm.
But like that puts to mind this image of like, if you eat heavy, all you're doing all the time is running around chasing another fatty dinner. You know what I'm saying? Which is maybe they were just like going out to nice places and loving each other. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that some of the stuff that I've found on the internet is her interpretation of when she was overweight.
It's also to sell the, you know, the lore of Weight Watchers.
Yes,
too, so,
exactly. Yeah. So I'm very aware that I think they dated for 2 years and then got married and they, you know, weren't dieting yet. So,
okay.
You know, and in the zeitgeist of the world in the 40s, people weren't going on all these diets.
No. And I mean, she got a husband like who?
Yeah. What's the problem? What's your girl?
Women usually get skinny to get a husband and then they're like, you got me. I got you now.
I'm tired. And I'm hungry. I'm tired. And I'm hungry. And I'm sad because I don't have equal rights. So this is delicious. Right.
It is what? 42. So
yeah. No. Yeah. They get paid 12 cents on the men's dollar. Forget it. I'm going to eat ice cream. All right. So they ended up having 2 children, David and Richard. So they moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then Warren, Pennsylvania. They moved around for a bit. And then in 1952, they settled in a modest apartment in Little Neck, Queens, which is right outside of New York City. Mm-hmm. And he became an airport bus driver. She wasn't working. She raised funds for charitable groups, including a place called the North Hills League for, I'm going to say what it was called at the time, retarded children. Please don't use that word, guys. Yeah. I just like to point out that these things were normal and that they shouldn't have been.
That was on a building somewhere.
That was on a building somewhere, like in big letters. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Okay. And she was also its president. So during all of this time that she was spending, she battled her weight and she hated the fact that she was overweight. It took over her mind. It took over her body. So I'm guessing she had disordered eating. Like there are things we can look back and be like, she was in a land of diet culture. Like it wasn't diet culture like we see it today, but it is the diet culture wherein society will tell you what you need to look like. And the more you feel bad about it, the worse it's going to get for you, basically.
Yeah. And back then they called it what? Reducing?
Reducing. Yeah. Yes. In order to reduce. I've seen old advertisements, like old, like black and white for like the most like, you know, take this cocaine. It'll help you. Reducing. Like the shit that was in there. Jesus.
Speed. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like if you're high, you're not eating.
Right. Right. It's literally going to put you to sleep for 20 hours. So it's fine. You won't eat. And she tried all the bullshit, right? So in 1961, she's 38 years old. She weighed 214 pounds. She was like, I think 5'7", whatever. I don't care. It's just a number. Point
I mean, that's big, but that's not like...
It's not
like... Yeah, it's not like... Because she's 5'7". It's not like she's 5'2".
Right. Like, I can't be that weight without a problem.
No.
I could do whatever I want. Please don't get me wrong. But my doctor's going to be like, this might be a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So what happened was she ran into an old friend and she was like, oh my God, you look great. Congratulations. When are you due?
Oh.
And Jean was like, what? Listen, we all know now that unless you are in the hospital or in a living room in a bath or something, crowning, like you have to be crowning, like you have to see the baby's head exiting the vagina. And then you could be like, oh, were you pregnant? That's the only time. That's the only time. I remember being so huge and people looking at me and not knowing what to say because I was so pregnant, but you can't really say anything. And I would be like, how's your day? You know, like, I'm not going to say it. Something. Are you going to say something? Because maybe I'm just fat. Okay.
I dare you to say it. I will say, with someone who has like issues with weight, that's got to hurt, man. Because if that happens to regular of us, we're like, well, I knew I was a little puffy, but I think I look pregnant. But damn, maybe I should do something about
it. Listen, I was in a store with a friend of mine. This was like right after college. And I remember this very well because my friend's beautiful and perfect and fine and a little extra fluff, whatever. And this 7-year-old fucking asshole, I'll say it, goes to her and says, something like, when's your baby due? And I swear to God, that child knew because I looked at that child like, don't fuck with my friend. I didn't say that to a child, but y'all raise your kids better than that.
Yeah.
And my friend was really sad. It was, that sucks. Oh. That sucks. So she, like, I would say, like, freaked out.
She spiraled.
She spiraled. Yeah. Her spiral ended up making her a millionaire. Mm. So she joined a free 10-week weight loss program. Let's talk about free again. That sounds nice. And it was sponsored by the New York City Board of Health's obesity clinic. Apparently they had one back then. Okay. The program was called the Prudent Diet, and it was developed in the 50s by Dr. Norman Joliffe, who was the head of the board's Bureau of Nutrition. So the plan basically like no skipping meals and fish 5 times a week, 2 pieces of bread and 2 glasses of skim milk a day. More fruits and vegetables. Also, you had to, everything sounds fine, except you had to eat liver once a week. No, thank you. I will not do that. No. But also, you couldn't have alcohol, you couldn't have sweets, and you couldn't have fatty foods. So it included like the foods you were allowed, how much you could have of it, and they encouraged weighing portions, like all kinds of shit to fuck you up in your head. But they were
that's
fine
not
like
a bad
that.
Diet, but I wouldn't it's not. Be weighing it's, food. But
that's the thing. Like, it's like, oh, yeah. These are like healthier. That's like as a parent raising kids, it's like what you want to do is give them information about food.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't want to be like, oh, pizza every day is so good and have ice cream.
Yeah. Fish 5 times a week and vegetables. And yeah, that doesn't sound bad at all.
That sounds great. Actually, yeah. But like, you don't have to weigh it. Just eat the fish.
Don't weigh it.
And if you're hungry, eat a little more fish.
Yeah. Exactly.
If you need more have some rice, that's fine.
Yeah,
you know,
that's fine.
But like, so she lost weight. She lost 20 pounds, but she didn't like the way that the leader at the clinic like managed the weekly meetings. So basically the weekly meetings were them talking at you. And she was like, this would be better if like I could talk about how I feel. Also, the problem was like, she really loved Malamars. Do you remember Malamars? So it's like
marshmallows and cookies.
Like marshmallow. And then it was like in dark chocolate. I loved them as a kid.
I mean, who doesn't? I mean, she's a human being who likes tasty food. That sounds delicious.
Right. Like we're not dead. Malamars are delicious. Okay.
Yeah. You just can't have them all the time every day.
Girl used to sneak it in the closet. She would like hide and like eat her Malamars. So like all kinds of like diet bullshit. That's the problem.
And shame
you should be able to
it.
Have right. Like let her have a Malamar. Goddamn.
Yeah.
But she felt like That's my interpretation. I don't think that was her interpretation, but she felt like because she was leading this like shameful life, if she could create like an honest, supportive community of other women who were dealing with this, or people, I should say, because it wasn't just women. So she began a weekly support group and she invited 6 overweight friends. And you got to wonder how overweight were these people? Right.
Yeah. Cause she lost 20 pounds. Yeah. 20 pounds is a lot of weight. Like that's not, I know. She should be very proud of herself.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But like wasn't enough. So she started this. So she introduced this same diet to those friends, except they're going to meet as a group. And, you know, the group provided empathy and rapport and understanding and all the things, you know, stories. They included a weekly weigh-in. And she developed a reward system, which included prizes for weight loss milestones. In 1962, she achieved her target weight of 142 pounds. This woman maintained that weight loss for the rest of her very long life. Okay.
Oh.
Interesting. Now, I'm going to side note here. I went on Weight Watchers in college. And I think that there's something, that's why I'm like, I think she's interesting. I think diet culture is very detrimental to the world. I think it's a great way of controlling women because if I'm worried about what I look like, what size jeans I wear, I'm not saving the world. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's a great way to keep women down and make us be judged by what we look like. That said, It is supportive. It does, make you feel like a human in a world where diet culture is so pervasive that being overweight in the world is hard to be treated as such. Like that's a problem. So she created a safe place for people to be overweight. However, if they continue to be overweight, it wasn't so safe, right? Like you're not losing
weight. And I was going to say, I just don't like the public weigh-ins. I think it's horrible. Yeah, I mean, because you could be like, oh, that gives you encouragement. It's like, oh, but what if I had a rough week and I ate Malamars?
Right. I mean, honestly, like when I did it in the late 90s, you could go behind a thing, but you absolutely, right. So that you, but it was still one person.
Yeah, and you just announced like, oh, you lost, you know, they can announce it like, oh, you lost 3 pounds or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
1 pound. Yeah.
It's just like your worth should not be that you lost 3 pounds and therein the problem lies. Right.
Yeah. And I get like, and I've never gone on Weight Watchers, but I know, but I definitely did Slim Fast, starving, all that other stuff many women. Yeah. Some bullshit. Yeah. But I know people who actually went on Weight Watchers. And I remember there was this girl, she was getting ready for her wedding. She started fitting into her dress.
Okay.
And I remember like when she showed me what she was eating, I was like, oh, you're actually eating, like you're eating food. But like you said, you have to measure it. And I think now it has like points or whatever, but like, she lost like, I think she lost like 25 pounds or something. And like, and I remember thinking, oh yeah, it does work. I think it works if you have a pretty normal, healthy body association or relationship with your body. I think it becomes problematic if you have, you know, body dysmorphia or some other psychological things going on.
I probably have had body dysmorphia on and off. Most of my life, if I look back at pictures, I'm like, oh, that wasn't fat at all.
yeah. And I think it's harder. I think it's different when you're younger, too, because as you get older, you're like, I'm sexy. I remember when I was younger and I used to go to this all women's gym and these older Caribbean ladies, and they'd be playing like dance hall and like Caribbean music. And these older Caribbean ladies, obviously they're there to lose weight, but like they were like, you know, some of them were pretty hefty women and they were like, I'm sexy. I'm whiny, sexy.
Yes.
And I'm like, how can I be that confident? And I'd be hiding behind like big baggy clothes. But I was like, oh, it's just age. As you get older, you're like, I'm sexy. I'm in it.
Right.
So like, no matter what size I am, I'm sexy.
I think that's how it should be done, honestly.
Yeah. Shout out to the Caribbean ladies. Yep.
Yeah. Caribbean ladies. Like, I was a white girl in the 90s. 90s with a bootay. And so it was like, it was really like, oh, I got to lose it. That's why when I look back at pictures, I'm like, I was fine. I was fine.
If you were a black girl, your association with your body would be a whole different relationship. You'd be like, you're like, I'm pulling these boys. Okay. That's with the dog on dog. Okay.
And in my late 40s, I'm like, it got even better. Okay. You're welcome.
Yeah. But okay. But back to.
So.
Yeah.
So here's what happened. So she's doing this. She's doing the thing. And then she starts to have other groups in the neighborhood, and she's coaching them. And at one of the group was the home of Al and Felice Lippert. And they both, husband and wife, successfully lost weight. And Al, who was a businessman in the garment industry, talked her into making a business out of her endeavor. So all of the stuff she had done before that, she wasn't charging. She was just like, come over. Right?
Oh.
And so she and her husband and Al and Felice formed a corporation, and they named it Weight Watchers. In May 1963, so in a loft over a movie theater, she became the president. So its revenue model was interesting. So franchise holders, which you had to be a graduate of Weight Watchers, and many of whom were women with an investment in the company that was like not just financial, but like they lost weight there.
Yeah.
They paid around $2,000 and were contractually obligated to pay Weight Watchers 10% of their gross revenue. Go make a lot of money.
Yeah. So 2000 and 1963?
Yes, 1963.
That's a lot of money, though.
That's a lot of money, right?
$2,000, not a lot of money now, but that was about 20,000, a little bit over 20,000, like 20,000 and a half, like 20,500.
How many franchises she started out with at the beginning.
Yeah.
But it was really popular. So they rented a public meeting. They would rent like public meeting venues. They charged $2 per weekly meeting. The first official meeting was May 1963, as soon as they formed, right? 400 people showed up. They had 50 chairs. 400 people showed up.
Oh, wow.
So they're still doing the weigh-in, the mutual support. The diet was basically the same thing that I said earlier. But their big thing was psychological. Right.
Yeah,
they taught journals to keep track of what you ate. They created diets with realistic goals. So they would talk to you about that. They created lifelong maintenance programs, which means lifelong members. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Then they started creating magazines and books and television forums, and camps. They had motivational speakers. So Al was in charge of the business end of the company, and he's the one who franchised it in 64. Okay. The business boomed. In 1967, the company went international. They had 102 franchises in the US, Canada, Puerto Rico, Great Britain, and Israel. So,
wow.
By 1968, 5 million people had enrolled. Five million people.
So only like 5 years later?
Yes.
Damn. Yes.
Now, Jean was its public image. So she was a dynamic speaker. She was like sincere. Her background was, you know, was one of the women. Like, again, you wanted to have a beer with her. Right.
Right. Right.
And her thing was, if I can do it, anybody can do it. So, right. Again,
I mean, I understand why this was a hit. I get why it was a hit, because you know, before that, you're kind of trying to do it on your own, and you may or may not have support at home.
Right.
You know, many women, your husband can eat anything and never gain a fucking pound. And you're like,
that
I
is
hate
my
him.
Life. Oh, that's my
like,
life.
You're like, I hate that's you so much.
Life. Hate him you know? So much. Yeah, yeah.
Or you have family members, or maybe you just need like, it's a social thing. It's a social club, really. Because also it's like, oh, have you tried this exercise? Or have you tried this place? So it's like a social, it's like a diet gym before gyms became a thing, basically.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. It's a place to like, yeah. I mean, that's where I'm thrown, because it really did put dieting smack in the heart of our culture.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't just like, oh, she wants to reduce a little. It was like, oh, you're doing.
Yeah. Because also it became a moneymaker thing. And I mean, one thing I can say about Weight Watchers, I don't know if it's been this way from the beginning, but one thing I always liked about when I saw people on it is that they were losing weight at a normal rate.
I mean,
they weren't like,
yeah,
you know, they weren't dropping like 10 pounds in like a week.
If you walked in and you dropped 3 pounds that week, having done it in the late 90s, whatever they were doing before, they would be like, that was a lot.
Are
you,
lot, yeah.
you know, like you, maybe you'll plateau next week and that's okay. Like they weren't,
it was an extreme diet.
It wasn't extreme. It's not extreme. You're definitely not supposed to be hungry. It's,
right.
If you're going to live in this world, it's not absurd. I just don't like the message that for women to be accepted or even healthy, they need to lose weight. There's just lack of information about body weight and health as it correlates. Now, obviously, there are some higher risks.
Yeah. I know what you're saying. Like it has a potential to be used for the wrong reasons, to be abused, like the idea, like the, and like you said, it made diet culture like central to society in a way that it wasn't.
Right.
Whereas like, you know, when I think we talk about Marilyn Monroe, she was into Pilates and weightlifting at a time where that wasn't like considered normal. Like women exercising to lose weight back then, women dieted to lose weight.
Right.
And not necessarily exercise to lose weight.
No, because they're not sweating. No, they're women. They're ladies.
Yeah.
Right? So you basically have to starve yourself.
Yeah.
And I don't like that.
Yeah. No, and I understand because it's, but you know what I say? It's like the cosmetic industry, right?
Yeah.
Fashion industry. We have a love-hate relationship with it. Like, it can be abused and often is, like that idea of like making your like hair color, getting a haircut,
right,
or buying this dress or da da da. It's like, it's a good thing, but then it's also easy if young girls are exposed to that kind of thing before they're old enough to know. I often think of that scene in Little Miss Sunshine when they're at the diner.
Yeah.
And she's eating and she's being an adorable, precious little thing. And just, and then her dad's just like, you think she should eat that? And it's like, and she's like,
oh my
what?
God. I want to punch like, him in the face every time.
Cause
I see
she has
that
a
scene.
Girl, she has a kid body. She has a little girl body. She doesn't, but to their point, they go into a beauty contest, right? A contest. Like, and it's like, like she's so young. She shouldn't be going to a beauty contest, but and she shouldn't be made to be self-conscious about eating when she's 8.
No, exactly. Like, and like, that's the problem. That's a big problem, right? Yeah. That's not okay. Like,
she's got plenty of time to obsess over her weight.
Oh my God, calm down. Like, you know, like let her be a kid. And also PSA, y'all, kids, 9, 8, 9 are prepping for puberty. So sometimes they'll start to gain weight. They're supposed to. That is their body prepping for puberty. So calm down.
Yeah.
That was another TED talk today. I'm doing a lot of TED talks today. Okay. So, in 1968, the company had 91 franchises in 43 states.
Wow.
So there's just, they just exploded. Now, Neidich, Jean, was slim, well-dressed. She was charismatic. She published in 1970 a book, The Memoir of a Successful Loser, The Story of Weight Watchers.
That's a great title.
Right?
That's a great title.
So in 1971, her marriage ended in divorce. There's like a quote I found somewhere that she's like, I think he liked me better when I was fat. I'm like, I'm not getting.
I mean, the men probably wouldn't check her for it like that. And then she get this, maybe she rich.
You know, and she does what she wants.
But I also
know?
Will say that she's feeling better about herself. So she's probably making more of an effort in putting in how she looks too.
Yeah.
And then her confidence is just, and if she's already charismatic, so he probably didn't like the competition from the other men.
Probably not. In the early 70s, probably not. Yeah. I read that she married again in 1975 for like a few months. She met a bass player on a cruise. They got married for a few months. And I'm like, you get yours. You do you need to do with this bass player. Okay.
I'm going to need you to simmer down. Just fool around. Oh, it's the 70s though, so they don't even know about that. Just fool around, girl. You rich now. You ain't got to get married.
No. You did not need to walk down an aisle for that. So in 1973 she resigned as president of the company. She focused on like public relations, but she kind of wanted, she was basically a consultant and basically wanted to do what she wanted to do.
She didn't want a job.
Right.
I'm rich now. I don't blame her either.
She was 49 years old. Oh, that sounds nice. Basically in the 70s, the company had basically grown too large and complex for Al Lippert to manage it. It was sold along with its food licenses to the H.J. Heinz Company in 1978 for $72 million.
Damn.
So Lippert remained chairman and he was CEO for a few years. Jean remained a consultant and she got $5.5 million for the sale. She remained the face of Weight Watchers until 1984. Now, in my research, you know how we like look for all the things. I saw an article from the Daily Mail, so please take that into consideration. Hashtag not historians. When I share that she moved to Vegas in the 90s and lost much of her money gambling.
No.
So by her 80s, she was no longer a millionaire.
No, now, Jean, no, girl.
Yeah. Now, I hope the Daily Mail was just like lying because they do that sometimes. Hashtag not historians. Allegedly, they allegedly do that sometimes. Don't come at me. It's in the UK.
Just so you know, what you said, 1973?
Is when
she got the money when they sold the company?
Oh, they sold the company in 1978.
So just so you know, $5 million in 1978 was $24
million. Yeah. It was like a lot of money.
For a company that they had for about, 15 years?
Yeah. I mean, my God. I'm fucking up my life because she clearly found something. What else in society can we prey on in order to make millions? I'm just curious. Asking for a friend. So she also established a scholarship at UCLA for women studying political science. She says, how do I bring this back to politics? Well, let me tell you. Quote, I don't think I'll make it as president of the United States, but some woman can and will. I'd like to be instrumental in that. End quote.
Okay.
Basically, y'all, whether you love her or hate her, let's make a woman president. Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's not wrong about that. Okay. So, FYI, as of July 2018, Weight Watchers was the most widely used commercial diet in the world. She died April 29th, 2015 of natural causes at her home in Parkland, Florida at the age of 91. Her son Richard actually had passed away in 2006. I couldn't figure out why, but her son David is still alive and she has 3 grandchildren. So that is her.
Yeah, I understand your conflict with the idea of diet culture. It's one of those things where it's like I said, it reminds me of like makeup, the love-hate relationship women have with makeup or any kind of cosmetic skincare stuff. It's like, you know, do you want to look natural? Do you want to, it's like, and then the filler people or the people who get plastic surgery to look like a cat. It's like, you know, it's rife with, with abuse and like, but I love the idea that it's always, Weight Watchers has always been like social. like,
yes. And I give it that credit. And like, it's one of those places where you could go in and say, I hate diet culture, and people will agree with you. You know what I mean? Like, it's because I'm always of two mindsets. Women can be whatever the fuck they want. Whatever the fuck they want. Wear makeup, don't wear makeup. I don't give a shit. Be fat, be skinny, be tall, be short. What? Be you. Be like your most confident you. But how do we fight through the noise to find what that truly is? And that's like, I think half the battle is just calling it out. Is like, do you want to be skinny because you feel like, why? You know, like... like, you don't have to be. You can be super confident. Be a Caribbean lady. Okay. And the all ladies.
Sexy. And sexy. I'm sexy.
Like, do that.
And they're right. They are sexy.
Yeah.
For me, it's not even about, like, if you want to be skinny, you want to be skinny. You know, we all feel better at different weights or whatever. For me, it's the eating. It's the punishing yourself for eating.
I think that is the problem.
I think that's the problem for me. Like, if you want to eat, like, even if you're dieting, if you feel like, I want to have a cupcake and it's not really, just have a cupcake and don't hate yourself.
And move it along.
Just, I mean, and I don't mean like have a cupcake and then throw it up, or have a cupcake and then spend an hour on the treadmill. Just have a cupcake and be like, you know what? I'll just make it up. Like, I'll make it up tomorrow. Maybe I'll work out a little bit extra. I'll lift more weights or whatever.
Even
but like
that, you've got to be careful, because it's something called orthorexia. Where, I mean, I had that in college. I didn't even know it was a thing, but I read about it and I was like, oh shit, I totally did that. Where if you eat something, you have to go work out. If you eat something else. And I remember I had one day, it was in college, and you know, sometimes food is everywhere in college, like this these people are having a party.
That's why you gain.
Oh, you want a slice of pizza? Da, da, da. And there was a day where I was like running into that. I went to the gym and then I ran into it again. Someone was like, oh, you want? I was like, okay. And then I went back to the gym. I went to the gym three times that day. And on the way home from that night, I remember being like, and I had been playing those games for a while. And that night I thought, okay, this is not healthy. Like, I didn't know this thing existed, but I just sort of managed to self-regulate that shit. But like, that's real. There's so many ways of it getting in your head, and that's dangerous. And it's also like, I could have been protesting some war somewhere. Okay.
Yeah. That's better. The thing, like, eat the cupcake and forget about the cupcake. Don't torture yourself. Don't fixate on the cupcake. That's where you want to get in life. So like, if you want to lose weight because you just want to feel better in your body, you want to fit, you want clothes to fit a certain way. Okay, I get it. That, I don't think anything's wrong with that. But what we're talking about is the obsession and also berating yourself for not being able, for eating the cupcake. Don't berate yourself for eating the cupcake.
If there's one thing y'all get out of this episode, is that wherever you're at right now, that's a beautiful before and after picture. That is exactly where you need to be in this time and space. And don't forget that your body is doing magical, amazing things, just keeping you alive. Just keeping you alive. Give it the credit, y'all, that it is due. Okay?
Yeah.
So,
because like, I mean, because in my head, I'm sexy like Meg Thee Stallion.
You are.
Now, when I look in the mirror, I don't necessarily see that, but.
No, I'd see it. I see
I'm,
it.
In my head, I'm a bad bitch, okay?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, on that note. All right.
That wraps it up for another episode of Notorious Women Podcast. Guys, remember to follow us on all the things. Please leave us a 5-star review on Spotify as well as the Apple Store. I don't think you can, I think you may be able to do one on iHeart app, but I'm not sure. But definitely Spotify and the Apple Store. If you want to help us out financially, you can donate to patreon.com/notoriouswomen. That's patreon.com/notoriouswomen. And Miriam, how else can they support the show?
Y'all, we have Instagram. Come to the Instagram. It is Notorious Women Podcast. There is some fun things, and I like to add little bits to coincide with the episode. So please join us there. We also have an email if you want to email us. It's notoriouswmpod@gmail.com. You can also DM us on Instagram. It's up to you. Whatever, you know, if you have short things, DM us. If you have longer things, send us an email. And that is that.
All right, guys. Thank you. And we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.